Welcome to the Reaction Podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, publisher of Reaction. Reaction, of course, we cover geopolitics, politics, economics, culture, and I'm delighted that today I'm joined by Tim Montgomery, a great friend of Reaction. And it's a while since we've talked, Tim, on one of these podcasts.
Still going really well for the Conservatives, though, isn't it, Ian?
It's going really, really well for your party. And I just wanted to survey the wreckage, but I mean survey the landscape. We're just on the eve of party conference season. Westminster is back. And as you say, it's not going particularly well for the Conservatives. It looked, didn't it, 6 months ago, as though Rishi Sunak had some kind of bounce on the back of restoring some sense of competence, so on and so on. That doesn't really seem to have held. Labour still have a massive lead. And the Tories are pretty depressed, aren't they?
Pretty depressed is understating it somewhat, I think. It's just, I've changed my mind even in the last few days. I thought for a long time that the Conservative Party would probably be wise to play it long. Just in the hope that something might turn up, that scrutiny of Labour might mean that Labour's position would erode and the Tories would become a bit more competitive. I haven't been optimistic that the Conservatives could win the next election, but minimise the defeat. But talking to friends and family outside of politics in recent days, particularly with the cement scandal in schools and other public buildings, there just seems to be a mounting, rage is overstating it, but certainly anger of some kind that the longer the sort of the Conservatives cling to office, and it is almost clinging to office now, I'm beginning to think the worse the defeat is going to be.
Yeah.
It's as I think people think the Tory season is over. They've been a long 13 years and they want a new chapter to begin now. And the longer the Conservatives stand in the way of that, presiding over what I think Nadine Dorries said in a slightly controversial letter, but that expression, zombie parliament. I think the anger of people is going to grow. They don't want the Conservatives in office anymore. And I think if the Tories certainly go beyond May next year, they're really asking for trouble.
It's very striking, isn't it? Everywhere I go, everywhere you go, you encounter people, friends, family, people in politics, people interested in politics, and it is that moment. It's similar to 1996, but it's the get them gone moment, isn't it? It's you encounter it from Conservatives who now say those dread words for a governing party, time for a spell in opposition, and it's just tiredness, intellectual exhaustion, and I suppose something quite healthy in a democracy, isn't it? The idea that no one party can be in power forever. I mean, there has to be a natural shift at some point. Of course, that's not how it was supposed to play out for Rishi Sunak, was it?
No.
I mean, his shtick was that he was going to restore competence, decent government, standards, process. And I know you've been a critic of him, and I've criticised him at various points, but he has done that. I mean, in terms of the basic functioning of government, the machine, in contrast to the Johnson-Truss experiments, let's put it politely, you know that, of course, there are criticisms you can make of how Rishi Sunak performs as Prime Minister, but the basics are done well. He gets up every morning and functions in a way
He gets up every morning, yes.
and functions, if you let me finish. He gets up every morning and functions in a way which is recognisably prime ministerial in terms of how business is transacted, boxes are done, meetings are taken. You can say it's too businesslike, too technocratic possibly, but it is recognisably prime ministerial. But that doesn't seem to be enough.
I'm going to have to push back a bit on that.
Go for it.
I'm afraid. Look, he is more competent than Liz Truss. I will concede that.
That's really damning.
But to be honest, much more than that, I talk to cabinet ministers who don't really feel that right rounds are happening properly. They don't feel consulted on policy still. They it's a little bit like Theresa May in a way. Theresa May is a very details-orientated person, and that is Rishi Sunak's skill. Mm. He understands the policies he is approving of or rejecting. But what he isn't is particularly collegiate, I don't think. I think he doesn't involve other ministers in decisions. And I think partly we've seen with the Gillian Keegan business in the last week, number 10 in the Cabinet Office, I think, knew what she was going to do on schools. But I don't think there was proper involvement of other departments like health in this decision. And therefore, there wasn't a proper ministerial warning of the implications of the Gillian Keegan's decision. And I think there is a problem of the government acting using all of its talents. And I'm not entirely sure he has restored competence in the way that Mrs. Thatcher would, who did, certainly in her early successful days, surrounded herself with ministers who disagreed with her. Whereas what you've seen from Rishi Sunak in the last week with the appointment of Claire Coutinho, Grant Shapps, the replacement of Amber de Botton as head of communications, is very much bringing his best supporters around him. And it looks slightly bunkerish to me.
I should explain what the Gillian Keegan concrete story is, partly because, well, if anyone's listening from North America or elsewhere in the world, it will help sort of guide them through what we're talking about. But also, just because I've dipped back into a few of the old podcasts and things that we did a while back, so much has happened at such incredible speed. I'd forgot, did Suella Braverman resign at some point? All sorts of stories that we were talking about a year ago or 18 months ago, they happen. They seem like the biggest deal politically on earth. And then a year later, you can't really remember. I mean, Grant Shapps has had 5 jobs in the cabinet. I'd forgotten that he wasn't in the cabinet under Liz Truss and that he helped organise her defenestration. One of the reasons he became defence secretary, because Sunak is very loyal to him. But my point is, just it's worth just bringing people up to speed. The Gillian Keegan, education secretary, RAAC, which is reinforced concrete effectively, is in lots of buildings built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, stopped being used in Britain in the 90s. It's not just a British story, it's a European story. The story behind it is fascinating, if you like concrete, but has its origins in Sweden in the 1920s and then Germany. So it's everywhere. But the charge is that the British government has not done enough to get rid of this stuff. And I think where the story really lands, and it fits into that get them gone sense of things that I talked about earlier, is that it's this sense of public realm, just this erosion of the sense that the British public realm matters, or that the government cares for it properly. So this feeds into a Labour story of neglect and cuts and disregard for the public realm and the public sector. So I think it's really a very powerful story, which will resonate. And then of course Gillian Keegan famously was on a hot mic being recorded by ITV and said some bad words. So there it is for posterity. So for anyone listening in a year or two's time, that's who Gillian Keegan was. And, well, of course, she may run for leader of the Conservative Party. Who do you think the runners and riders will be, incidentally?
Well, I think Gillian Keegan, you shouldn't write her off yet, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought she was really amateurish when I saw that hot mic thing. And I don't think we know the answer to this question yet. I certainly don't know. But she could yet be the hero of this story. She was the education secretary, and that sort of came over in her hot mic remarks. Was she actually the first minister to really understand this was a massive issue? Or was she someone who panicked on inadequate information and has spooked the whole of all parents in the country about whether it's safe to send their kids to school? I don't think we know the answer to that yet, and I think probably we should have concrete experts discussing that rather than political experts.
But that's true.
She may yet be someone who people see as a frank, candid teller of the truth who tried to face up to an issue. So she's not out of it, actually, I don't think, yet.
And, I agree. I think her backstory, she was much mocked for that hot mic moment at Westminster, but actually I spoke to some people from the normal civilian, non-political world who thought it was rather amusing and candid. And, of course, there's not, the only thing that's disliked more than the political class, which the media often forgets, is the media class.
Indeed.
So the media class saying, "Oh, look, she spoke out of turn and used a bad word on Mike," is a very 1990s way of viewing things, whereas actually people could see her as plain speaking and frustrated with the way in which the media turns all of these things into a scandal, rather than a really complex public policy problem, which is going to take years, decades, and it's going to be very expensive to resolve. Just back then on the
question,
on the Tory leadership question.
Yes.
Now that was, we're assuming there that the Conservatives lose the next election.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not completely impossible that Rishi Sunak pulls it off, gets a majority of five. Something fundamentally changes in the economy, or there's a scandal that hits Labour. So that, there's that possibility. But let's work on the assumption that there's a Labour majority of some kind. First part of the jigsaw is, does Rishi Sunak go straight away? I would argue that if it's a small Labour majority, he should stay. I'm sure you wouldn't necessarily agree with that.
I can't wait to see the back of him. But I don't. The Tory Party...
you've got to come off the fence here.
just that the Tory Party is so ruthless, though, Ian. You may be right. Maybe you are wise in that. I don't agree with you on that. But the Tory Party always gets rid of leaders who lose elections.
Ted Heath didn't.
That was a big... That worked out well.
No, Ted Heath and Harold Wilson remained leaders despite losing general elections. And then if you're in a world of hung parliaments, highly factionalised parties, and the party might not be able to agree on a definite rally round a successor, Labour majority of 5 to 10 seats might not survive by-elections and economic crisis or all sorts of other... So I'm just...
Yeah,
there's a possibility.
That was half a century though ago. And I would say what the Conservative Party does need to do is need to choose a leader potentially quite quickly. Because if it is a little bit like 74, Labour have a very small majority or fall short of a majority. And I'm sorry now to Brenda from Bristol. Those people outside of Britain don't know, but she's famously didn't like lots of elections.
Yeah, which the voters don't. I mean, she expressed something on behalf of the voters famously by saying, oh, no, they haven't. They haven't called another election.
Not another one. It's very possible Keir Starmer would go to the country again and say, we didn't quite get over the line. Give me the opportunity to have a solid majority.
As Wilson did, won narrowly in 64. No, in 64.
Oh, 64.
64, and then he goes again and gets a proper majority in 66.
Wrong. Yeah, I'm getting my decade wrong.
Yeah.
And I think the British
But he did it again in 74. Yeah, effectively.
The British people are... They give you the benefit of the doubt in the beginning. Mm. And I think he would get the benefit of the doubt in a second election. And he'd certainly get the benefit of the doubt if the Tories in a very chaotic leadership election or are fighting amongst themselves. But I think the likelihood, I think James Cleverly, the current Foreign Secretary, would be in the running potentially as leader. Mm-hmm. But actually the three most likely next leaders are probably women, which would mean the Conservative would have their fourth woman leader.
So run us through those.
Penny Mordaunt.
Yeah.
Kemi Badenoch, and then perhaps Gillian Keegan, if she really flourishes from this cement scandal. I personally don't think any of those would actually lead the Conservatives into the following general election if the general election is a full parliament. I think none of them in my mind quite have the intellectual range that the Conservative Party will need to reinvent itself in opposition. I don't see the Conservative Party uniting very quickly, and I think the next leader will have a thankless task. But those would be my candidates.
Doesn't, just push back on that, doesn't Kemi Badenoch really have something potentially very special? That was seen in the previous leadership contest where she came close. Mm. She certainly has intellectual firepower. Look at the way in which, as a Brexiteer, she was prepared to push back against David Jones MP and others who were expected more respect from her as they were ancient Brexiteers, but actually she was just very punchy. Mm-hmm. I won't go into the boring details of what everyone was arguing about. Brexit arguments are increasingly boring. But she showed real sort of fire and drive. On the culture war stuff, which may be one of Labour's biggest weaknesses, she's very robust and probably on the side of the, or she's certainly on the side of the Tory membership and potentially Tory voters. And if Labour does become too woke in office, then there's a Labour vulnerability there that she could exploit. And Gillian Keegan has got, I think, an amazing potential connection if she survives this concrete scandal, if it is a scandal, has an amazing potential connection with voters, and I can see her attacking Starmer from a perspective of his privilege or his and I hate that the P word, but his status as Sir Keir Starmer, mm-hmm. London lawyer, aloof, mm-hmm. separated from the rest of the country. Her backstory and her experience, I think, could tell. So that's three. So Penny Mordaunt obviously has her strengths.
Holding up a sword at the coronation.
Exactly. And these things matter. These things matter with the Tories electorate.
Some, older gentlemen who were very excited impressed at that performance.
So she's, you know, she's been around in politics a long time now. Will certainly run. Who else was so plus Cleverly?
Yeah.
Is it too early for Claire Cattini, who I think is a real rising star in the Tory?
Yeah, I thought Claire was the most interesting. Claire's elevation to the energy net zero post was probably the most interesting part of the reshuffle. Actually, everyone focused on Grant Shapps becoming Defence Secretary, but I think what Rishi Sunak was doing was bringing on an ally, but someone also he thinks a lot of. And I think it probably was slightly unfair on her in a way. I think we bring on young talent too quickly, and then they get into top jobs when actually they haven't really had the experience of government that allows them to succeed in such jobs. So if she does now prosper, then she is confirmed as a real talent, because it's a very big brief, very sensitive politically, lots of policy challenge in it. If she masters that, then she's clearly up to the task. But in my view, it probably would have been her interest if there had been time for her to come back a little bit, come into my office a little bit later.
Yeah. I mean, but beyond the broader sort of general economic situation, she's dealing with the number one concern. Well, other than general economic problems, plus the war in Ukraine, but energy and net zero, of course, is related to that, is that she has to square this circle. And there is a part of the Conservative Party now, the very green part of the Conservative Party, that's almost irreconcilable with the rest of the party. I mean, you know where I stand on this. I just think the net zero deadlines and the way that it's being pursued are completely insane. I don't think we'll hit the dates. Most of those dates are chosen just because Boris Johnson, who's not a details person, wanted to show off and set dates that are ahead of the European Union. Do we actually think that he studied supply chains and how the car industry works and how you build energy security? Of course he didn't. So we have these dates plucked out of the air, which the ultra-greens say must be hit. Europe is being deindustrialized. The European car industry is just cannibalizing itself. And the only winner is going to be China, who are making all these batteries and electric cars, which can be produced more cheaply and will flood Europe in 10 years' time. 10 years' time, people will say, why are the roads, whatever happened to VW, you know, Volkswagen and BMW and the European car industry? Europe, including Britain, is kind of very vulnerable on the search for rare earths, minerals, which is a war effectively between China and the US. And in the middle of all of this is the energy and net zero secretary, who I think has to find find some kind of compromise or some kind of way of explaining to people that great, cleaner energy gets cleaner energy, but it's going to take decades. Let's do it in a manageable way that keeps the lights on.
Absolutely.
And one of the main reasons we're suffering from the economic shock from inflation and British businesses are struggling is that they're paying such high costs for energy compared to the US. I mean, if you want the big part of the answer why the US has consistently grown since the financial crisis and recovered amazingly well is down to
cheap energy.
Cheap, plentiful energy.
Absolutely.
It is now going green or towards cleaner energy, but America seems to get the balance right. So that's an enormous political challenge for her.
Parts of America do. You know, I think you look at the difference between Texas and Florida, for example, Republican-run states that are happy to embrace shale and other.
True.
And then you have places like Hawaii and California, which have really gone down the renewables route. They haven't invested in their transmission infrastructure. They haven't really allowed manufacturing industry to survive in their states.
Yeah.
And we've seen the consequences.
So there's a task for Claire Coutinho. I mean, really, really straightforward. You know, just can she completely transform British energy policy and tell voters the truth? I mean,
if she doesn't succeed in that, we'll all criticise her hugely.
Precisely.
What I like about what you've just done, though, is, you know, we're having a discussion about how awful the Tory party is, and of course they are pretty awful. But, you know, where do you go to in the Western, amongst the Western democracies at the moment, and see a government really firing on all cylinders? The revision to GDP data recently showed actually the British economy wasn't faring as badly as anyone thought. We're in the middle of the pack, but you know, particularly then. But then you look at, you know, Biden now, 73% of Americans think he's unfit to be president. In Germany, you have the far-right AfD, 20% or so in opinion polls. Le Pen would win a presidential election in France if it was held now. Vox doing very well in Spain. Italy, we know what's happened there. You know, there's barely a Western democracy where actually there isn't trouble. And so Labour are the hope at the moment, and you've, you know, written quite a positive column in your recent Times recently. But, you know, I sort of hear Labour spokesmen going onto radio and television, the Tories are underfunding the health service, the Tories are underfunding the justice system with this prisoner escape, the Tories are underfunding. Okay. Every time Labour say, but what are you going to tax? You're going to change the VAT policy on private schools and you're going to make a slight adjustment to non-DOMs. But where's the honesty?
Yeah.
If there is such massive underfunding, where are you going to change things?
Yes.
And those questions aren't being asked yet. And the Tories had a bad summer. They tried to sell their policy on boats in the NHS. None of it went well. What Kenneth Baker did many years ago with a sort of summer heat on Labour policy was recognise that people weren't going to fundamentally change their view of the Tories, but they could still attach a price tag to Labour, that there would be a downside in voters' minds for voting Labour. And that, I think, is all the Tories really have left now in the locker, is to run the kind of campaign that Norman Lamont ran in 1992, the tax bombshell campaign, saying that the average family would pay £1,250 more under Labour. Mm. Find something like that so that before voters put their cross next to the Starmerites or whatever they're called in the ballot box, they have a pause for thought, because at the moment they don't.
Yeah, very interesting. Just on your point about leadership, there's an election in Poland this year. I'm not going to stray into Polish politics, which is a very hard fought territory, and very, very divided. But what's happening in Poland is fascinating compared to, you mentioned the problems in France and Germany. Poland has been growing at a phenomenal rate. It's also the country which has got, and there's a cross-party consensus on this in Poland, which is unusual, has got out in front on defence spending, which will spend at least 4%, maybe 5% of GDP. Huge defence orders, which is placed around the world. And it's Poland on the front line against Russia, who has really shown some leadership and is out in front there saying, you know, even if Putin loses, or God forbid, if Putin wins in Ukraine, the Russia threat and being properly armed against whatever could emerge next over the next 10, 20 years in Russia, you just have to take the Kissinger principle, which is to push back hard at the earliest possible stage and be well armed
100%.
Against the Russian, and almost said Soviet threat, but against the Russian threat. The Poles have seen that very clearly. Yeah. So that's one country.
Well,
where there is leadership.
That would be the subject of a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
But if I had to name a centre-right government in the world that I would name as my favourite at the moment,
it
has some controversial downsides.
It does.
Yeah, it would be Poland.
Interesting. And just one thought, picking up on what you're saying about Labour, isn't there a case really for saying what's just happened over the last 5-6 years vindicates the British political system? Bear with me, this is a very unfashionable thought, that the choice at the last election was between Boris Johnson, deeply, deeply flawed for all of his political campaigning prowess, up against Jeremy Corbyn, a de facto, well, sort of a Marxist contender to be prime minister of this country. A terrible choice. And after that populist shock and everything that follows from Brexit and all of the bitterness and division, you actually end up with... Now, people can say, I don't think there's enough that separates the parties. Fine, that's a different argument. But the system has reset to two pretty effective technocrats, really, in Sunak and Starmer. Now, that might not be the most exciting choice, but what I mean is the two-party system. Labour has reorganised itself within 3 or 4 years from being completely unelectable to something, to a party which now doesn't really scare people. Mm. And the Tory party has moved on from Boris Johnson and Liz Truss into something more recognisable. Just on the Labour point, I mean, my positivity about it wasn't rah-rah Labour. I was simply making the point that Labour should cheer up a bit, because they have scope to do stuff the Tories can't really get away with. They will tackle the house building thing, because they can change the planning rules, which primarily affect Tory constituencies in the south. Concrete over much of the southeast of England, and it will
hopefully
be...
Hopefully not with RAC.
And hopefully not with RAC. And it will be... Of course, this will lead to problems later, but they will tackle the housing crisis, or they can tackle the housing crisis. That opportunity is available. They can probably get away with NHS reform in a way that the Conservatives can't. The risk comes on the tax base, and that's the thing that really worries me about Labour, is, and if Starmer has given pledges about income tax, I'm not sure whether I believe them or not, or about wealth taxes, the danger is that Britain's tax base is quite vulnerable and wealth is mobile. That to me is the question mark. What does Starmer really believe about wealth creation and wealth accumulation? Everything in his background suggests that he's very left-wing and doesn't really understand how wealth is created, how it's generated. So we'll see. So that, but I was being relatively positive about the opportunities available to the Labour Party.
My greater worry about Labour isn't actually whether they're fiscally responsible or not. They probably are less fiscally responsible than the Conservatives. My worry is more of Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, how she reacted to the whole woke bank scandal that we had earlier in the year. You know, the new socialism, if you like, isn't spending too much money. There's no more money to spend, really. It's turning private corporations into basically quasi-arms of the state, because there's so much compliance regulation, environmental regulation, equalities legislation now, that the human resource and regulated sections of bigger business in Britain now are just almost like arms of the state. And that's happened under Conservative government. Goodness knows how much further it could happen. The socialisation of business is my big worry about a Labour government.
Do you think that will be unpopular when Labour do that?
I mean, no.
Is that the...
Not immediately, but I think the long-term consequences of a less entrepreneurial, vigorous, dynamic private sector... will be hugely important for the competitiveness of Britain.
The catastrophe is the, and this is one for a whole other podcast, which we should talk about, which is really the takeover of many businesses by the HR function.
Yeah.
And the HR function plus the sort of diversity, equity, inclusion component of their work, and the way in which power has shifted within companies. And they're almost compliance machines.
Yeah.
There
are many good things about that in protecting vulnerable people, etc. But it's also inherently risk averse and cautious and bureaucratic, and that the influence of that culture on the whole of a company means that something that is intrinsically good in motivation ends up hurting the company when it becomes too powerful.
Tim Montgomery, we've covered a lot of ground on the Reaction podcast. Thank you for joining me. You've been listening to the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin. Thank you for joining us.